Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to this introductory episode of Your Own Personal Beatles, a new podcast about the Beatles with me, Jack Pelling.
And me, Robin Allender.
So in this introductory episode, we talk about our own personal Beatles and our introduction to the band, and we're just sort of getting to know each other a little bit. This was recorded back in the most intense section of lockdown on a very hot day a couple of months ago, and we were kind of in two minds about whether to start with this one, but I think because it sets the tone for the upcoming episodes, we thought we'll use this as an introduction, and you can listen to the two of us sort of getting to grips with the idea of the show and getting to know each other a little bit better.
Yeah, I think we covered a lot of ground in a way that was quite spontaneous, and we were thinking maybe we could try and re-record it, but we probably wouldn't get those stories right the same way or something. But it was good. I think we kind of discussed this great book that we're both reading, Dreaming the Beatles by Rob Sheffield, which has a lovely extract about the idea that the Beatles have kind of lived on in the lives of future generations and future fans of the Beatles, and how they've kind of become a different beast since the 60s. And that's kind of what we wanted to focus on, which is kind of what the Beatles mean to people now and how the Beatles have a place in everyone's kind of lives, really.
Mm. And then there's also some more kind of lighthearted chat about Beatle beards and Beatle hair.
Yeah.
And some funny stuff. So instead of kicking off with some of our big celebrity names, we thought we'd risk introducing it with our own sort of experience and stuff, so we can all get to know each other a little bit better, like on the first day of term. So thank you for downloading the podcast. You can subscribe on all good podcasting platforms now, and we're also on social media at Personal Beatles on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can also email us, and you will find all that information on personalbeatles.com. So enjoy Jack and Robin's Personal Beatles. Hi, Robin. How are you doing, mate?
Good. How are you doing, Jack?
I am very hot.
Yeah.
But very well.
Yeah, it's a hot day in lockdown. I'm just in my bedroom, and so obviously all the windows are closed, and the video is on. I was going to just do this just in my pants, but I think that might have been maybe too much, too distracting.
Yeah, I think I was going to go down a similar route, but I thought probably too alarming even for an audio-only format.
Yeah, indeed, the mental image. Where are you? You look like you're in a nice kind of studio, or have you just got some nice shelving?
I am not. I am in my dad's office,
right,
in my family home, which I've relocated to. So I'm sort of surrounded by tax returns and things that give me the heebie-jeebies, and printers that don't work, nice, and a fax machine from 1982.
Are those they're box files behind you? I thought they were boxes of cereal, but they are just
no. They're much blander than that. They are the shredded wheat of of bureaucratic documents. Unfortunately, not the most glamorous conditions, but. This is going to be a podcast about a little-known four-piece from the north of England who caused quite a stir in the 1960s. And we're going to just chat about the Beatles because we're both big fans. Mm. And I think there is, weirdly, a bit of a lack of Beatles podcasts out there. So considering we're two sort of mid-30s sort of straight white men, we thought probably need to get another podcast under our belts because... If lockdown has proved anything, that there aren't enough of us doing podcasts.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, when did you... I know you're a big Beatles fan, and, you know, we our paths have crossed a few times, but we don't know each other that well. Mm. But when did you sort of... What was your first kind of exposure to the Beatles?
For me, the first thing I remember was I had a videotape of the Yellow Submarine film, and I used to really... So this was when I was really young, like still in junior school. And I used to watch that quite a lot. And I used to... It had a really big effect on me. I used to, do you remember the scene where Ringo walks home to Eleanor Rigby? And there's the kind of looped footage of the kind of footballers and the cityscape and everything. Mm. I used to absolutely love that section. I just thought it was brilliant. I don't know why. But it wasn't like so much that from the musical point of view. I think it was the visual side that I really enjoyed. And then it was when I got very into music, I was probably more like 13, and I got very into Nirvana, completely obsessed. And then sort of felt a huge absence when Kurt Cobain died. And it was around that time, kind of 94, that my dad gave me a cassette which had Sgt. Pepper on one side. And I think it was like the second half of the White Album on the other side. Do you remember that with cassettes? It was like you'd often get, and it wasn't like a full album. You just like get the best of Dookie or something like that.
Yeah.
So it was like the second half of the White Album. And I just like that was, it just filled that gap for me. I think I was just, part of me had just had enough of, I kind of still liked a lot of loud, heavy music, but I think I was just ready for something that was a bit gentler and maybe more subtle than Nirvana or something.
And there is obviously a big Beatles influence that runs through Nirvana, especially that, especially Bleach.
Yeah.
You can tell that he was a bit obsessed with it, and I know his sort of, that even their production style was based on his sort of double tracking.
Yeah,
and
very Lennon-esque vocal style with on Nevermind and stuff especially. But yeah, you can definitely hear that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's. I think Yellow Submarine's a weird one because it tends to be a lot of people's starting point. Just because, I mean, my first song that I ever remember was Yellow Submarine because we used to sing it in nursery school.
Yeah, yeah,
which is quite bizarre, and it is quite a bizarre film and a bizarre record as well.
It is really, the actual Yellow Submarine album.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's interesting because I didn't really listen to the album much until this week, actually, because I just thought I'd better fill in a few gaps in my knowledge and stuff. But
it's definitely it's the weakest thing that they maybe, I'd say, Help. But the soundtrack records are pretty thin on quality, and you can tell that they were quite like rushed along. But I think there are some crackers.
Press pause and rewind. do you mean Help and Hard Day's Night aren't as good, or you just kind of
no I don't think that. I think you can definitely tell that they were written in a bit of a rush, right. And there's a lot of filler on them.
Yeah, but
there's great songs on them.
Yeah, I like Hard Day's Night and Help, actually. I was Yellow Submarine was definitely, but that's the mad thing about Yellow Submarine is that, wasn't it, they took a break from Sgt. Pepper to record some of the songs from Yellow Submarine, and it was, they seem to be able to multitask at doing this incredible album and then kind of just pop into the studio to put out a couple of,
record Hey Bulldog.
And
it sounds so rich and almost sounds like it was recorded quite a long time after. I mean, the chronology of them is funny in that period from sort of 66 to 68.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have any context of like when they were released growing up, and I had them all on vinyl and didn't really look at the copyright to see.
Right.
And I always assumed that because of the way that they sound, that Yellow Submarine was much later and that the White Album was much earlier, because
that's
the White Album is quite, it sounds quite sort of thin. And I've never really liked the way it sounds.
Wow.
Which is a different topic altogether, but until they re-released it last year.
Okay.
And they've done a whole complete sort of digital remaster that Giles Martin did, and it sounds like a new record and like the record I always wanted it to sound like.
Okay, so bass. Are you listening to it now as the mono version, or the like?
No, so this is, it's, I mean, they've modernized it and they've actually taken quite a lot of liberties with it. And I know a lot of people who think it's quite sort of sacrilege to play around with George Martin's mixes.
But I haven't listened to the White Album remasters, but I did listen to the Pepper ones that Giles Martin did, and I thought they were absolutely superb. But he did take liberties with it, which I think if anyone can, he can, kind of. But
yeah, exactly. And I think there's stuff, especially a lot of it was kind of, I suppose it's the sort of George Lucas argument, isn't it? But there was lots of things that just weren't sort of technically doable.
Mm.
And also, I've never really, as iconic as the Hofner violin bass is, I've never really liked the sound of it.
Yeah.
And I don't think it, like, especially in those early half of the Beatles' output,
right,
I've never been that into, because I love his bass playing so much, and it just doesn't really shine until you get into the later records.
Certainly the later ones, yeah, properly. With Abbey Road. The bass sounds incredible on Abbey Road. Talking about the chronology, I remember one thing that used to really confuse me when I was just getting through all the Beatles albums was, how did their hair grow so quickly? Do you ever think
yes,
about that?
I think about the beards more.
The beards, yeah. So if we look at Sgt. Pepper, 67, very short Edwardian-style haircuts on John there.
Yeah.
John had a very short haircut in Sgt. Pepper. I'm correct in saying that, aren't I?
Yeah.
The next year is 68. And in Magical Mystery Tour, in the film, he's got short hair.
Yeah.
Which is what, Christmas 67?
Yeah, that would be
68,
about right.
68, the White Album. 69, Abbey Road. His hair is almost down to his knees. How did that happen?
Hair grows down to his knees.
Yeah.
I think that, because when you watch it in the sort of anthology, there's sort
they
of
have
breaks
a
where
clip
there's no
of his hair growing.
Footage of them. Well, there's no footage of them for a while, and then you see them sort of walking back into the studio.
So do you think
and
when
I
they
can
were
only
in.
Imagine that taking heroin and LSD must be really good for hair growth.
Yeah, it must be. When they were in India, so you think when they went to India, that's when they really let their hair down, so to speak, and the hair grew.
I think in more ways than one, yeah. I mean, everyone, it does grow longer in the sunshine. Especially George Harrison, when he comes back for those sessions where he's got a huge beard and his hair is
what
really,
kind of
really long.
Let It Be sessions kind of vibe? Or
The sort of Teddington studio ones, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, George's hair, that's another. I mean, his hair was already quite long in 67, though. But yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, anyway, yeah.
But I don't know if you ever tried growing a big beard, because I have.
I can't really grow a big beard. But you've got a beard.
I have got a beard, but I try and stop when it gets about this length that you can see to the fascinating stuff for the listeners. It's about 7 millimeters.
But I can't. Mine just grows beneath the chin, and I guess get a kind of I'd call it a kind of puby mass on the cheeks.
So it's a bit like Ringo's beard.
Ringo, yeah, it's not very appealing. It no matter how long I've left it, it sort of still doesn't look like it looked like a real beard. It still looks like a pretend beard.
I mean, beards do take a bit of perseverance.
Yeah.
And you have to get through a lot of itchiness and uncomfort and straggly bits.
Yeah.
But what's your favourite? That's a good question, actually. What's your favourite Beatle beard?
Beatle beard. I think Paul had a lovely beard, actually, didn't he?
I've always wondered why. I suppose he's because he's got such like cheeky little cheeks.
Yes, yeah.
It's a shame to cover them up,
it is,
but he definitely, in the Let It Be sessions, had a lovely little beard.
He did. He had a lovely. So I was going to read a little bit from Dreaming the Beatles by Rob Sheffield.
Please do. I'd love to.
Because I thought this is a good starting point for kind of what we're trying to do. Because, like, you know, you're saying there are quite a few, there are Beatles podcasts out and about there. There's the Egg Pod and other ones. But, you know, we both were thinking there is this kind of thought, well, everything's been said about the Beatles. But then again, they still mean a lot to everyone, and everyone's discovering them all the time. Each generation discovers them for their own.
And there's not even a podcast about their hair and beards.
No, exactly. Which is mental. So that's what Dreaming the Beatles is kind of about. It's about the afterlife of the Beatles. So I thought this was a really lovely bit, and it's kind of would be. I think it's a good kind of way of describing, I guess, what we were chatting about. When we first spoke about doing this. So Rob Sheffield says, there's your public Beatles. You'll probably encounter their music somewhere in the next week, the supermarket or the laundromat or the car radio or a stranger's T-shirt. There's also your private Beatles. Your private Beatles. Yeah. Sounds quite funny, sorry.
Yeah,
the song you
that's what I call my private.
The song you love that isn't a hit, the classic you hate, the B-side nobody appreciates the way you do. People get fiercely protective about their personal Beatles.
How can we keep hearing our own secrets in these songs? How can they be the world's most passionately beloved band, yet still weirdly underrated? And how is there so much life in this music? Oh, untimely life. And he kind of quotes a little bit.
That's amazing.
Yeah, which is that...
What, that's such a good little prologue. Is that the introduction?
It's in the first kind of... First chapter, I think, yeah, an introductory chapter. But it's, I can heartily recommend it. It's good. But that's a great idea, I think, is this idea of the personal Beatles. And, you know, we've all got our own... They all mean something to us in different ways, I guess. So have you done your introduction to the Beatles? Describe your personal Beatles.
I mean, apart from sort of learning Yellow Submarine at the age of four in nursery school, It's records that my parents had, which I think for a lot of people of my generation is... I mean, my parents are not the most sort of... My dad's a big jazz fan, and he grew up in sort of 1950s, so he's just a little bit too young for like full-on Beatlemania teenage years. Yeah. But he did see them in 1963, when they were touring with Helen Shapiro, which was the first tour that they did, where he saw them at Colston Hall.
Wow, that's incredible. God, my dad sounds a similar age. He was also a big jazz fan. And he kind of
and
got...
Is he a Bristolian as well?
Well, he went to Bristol University, and he was get a ticket to see them at the Colston Hall, but he saw the queue and thought, oh, no, I can't be bothered. So that's a mad link. Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. My dad was inside. Because he was very much there to see Helen Shapiro, who, if people aren't familiar with her, was like a very popular in 1962, 1963. He was never a big Beatles fan, but he did remember them being absolutely phenomenal and the reaction to them being incredible, which from my dad, who's has a similar attitude to the Beatles as James Bond in Goldfinger, when he says... drinking warm Bollinger 53 is like listening to the Beatles without earmuffs. classic Connery. But gave the bad impression. But yeah, that was kind of my dad's thing. He was much more of a traditional, like, Duke Ellington sort of thing. But they still had all the records, and my mum was into a lot of, I mean, pretty horrible stuff. But in that, there were a few gems within the sort of Grease soundtrack and Robert Palmer records of... not that we like bashing Robert Palmer. He's some good stuff out there. But yeah, they...
But that's interesting because my...
Yeah, they had them all littered.
My dad was a kind of... He got into a lot of the... He was big into jazz and classical. But then he was into the 60s stuff and Beatles and Stones and one or two other things from that. And Dylan and things like that. But my dad's thing was it was almost a bit later than your dad because when it got to the 70s, he always said the 70s was the record where he didn't buy any new records or something.
Really?
So like Bowie, punk was just...
Pick the wrong decade to do that.
He just absolutely did not understand Bowie, not understand punk. It was just gross to him.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because you think, I mean, I'm so jealous of my dad growing up at that time and being the perfect age to, you know, pop down to the Isle of Wight to see Jimi Hendrix or something, but he was more interested in... I think he was seeing his music taste was incredibly uncool, but like me, he was a bit sort of defiantly, you know, anti the zeitgeist in, you know, in the same way that, you know, you'll be recommended something that everyone's watching and you refuse to watch it because you're stubborn old git like I am.
Yeah, but that isn't actually... I'm sure that attitude is... I mean, we have this idea, don't we, of the, like, golden era of the 60s, but for most people it wasn't like that at all, really. I mean, for the majority of people, I mean, like, you know, the whole thing with Engelbert Humperdinck, Please Release Me, would beat Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane to number one. And it's, well, you know, that wasn't a huge upset because that was what most people were listening to.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. There was just a lot of pop music and light music, I suppose you might call it, like, kind of a light entertainment style.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
And there was just, that was huge.
Yeah, sort of Radio 1 didn't really even exist until the sort of late 60s, so... There were only sort of illicit ways, you know, I think they had Luxembourg FM and stuff, but I suppose because you're so used to seeing sort of montages of Carnaby Street soundtrack to, you know, Penny Lane or whatever, that you think that was in the public consciousness. But yeah, it was probably was. Yeah, you're completely right. It was more sort of how much is that doggy in the window and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is kind of mad. But, you know, that was my sort of upbringing of it. And then I think, I mean, I know you're a musician as well, but I've sort of, all of my kind of formative relationships are completely based around music. So it was then something that I shared with everyone else. And then I got to know all the records. I think getting a car was at sort of 16, 17 was quite a fundamental changing point, because people had loads of tapes of records that I'd never heard. So I never really heard Revolver until I was about 17. So that was pretty incredible. So I kind of went backwards, really. I grew up on Abbey Road and Sergeant Pepper, and then I kind of worked backwards as I got older.
Right. Yeah, I just, I guess, I suppose because my parents separated, and so it was whenever I went round to Dad's house, I'd come back with another Beatles album, or he'd give me another tape of a Beatles album, and I'd gradually piece them all together like that. And that was how I did it. So it was quite random. I think, like, I'd get the Red album and then, like, Abbey Road and then, like, you know, Rubber Soul and then the White album or whatever, you know. Yeah. It was all just, you know, amalgamated in my mind. But weirdly, I still, after all this time, have blind spots. It's like I was chatting to John about this because, you know, my friend John Robbins, who, as you know, is an enormous Queen fan.
Yeah.
He was completely obsessed with Queen, but for some reason he always just leaves like two albums he doesn't get when he's obsessed with an artist or something. So he like got really into Zappa, but then he didn't quite complete the collection or something like that.
Yeah. You know?
So I was a bit like that with the Beatles. Like, I still to this day, Let It Be is like a huge blind spot. I've never got into the album.
Yeah.
I haven't watched the film. I've listened to it, but it's just not one of my.
It's a weird one,
Touchstones,
because it is a bit of an afterthought, and it was, you know, released, like, they held back the release because they weren't happy with it, and then we had the, you know, horrible Naked Sessions, and it's such a fractious record. But it's sort of, I was quite interested to, sit, like, read the other day about how sort of critically maligned it was for a really long time, but actually, there's great stuff on there, like, really, really great.
Yeah.
I mean, I love things like Dig a Pony and... what's the other really great song on that? I've Got a Feeling is amazing. And then...
And the singles are great.
And Long Winding Road and Let It Be, yeah. But it does sound...
And Across the Universe, right, is on Let It Be, is it?
Is on Let It Be, yeah. And I love Billy Preston's organ playing and everything that he does. And, you know, it's sort of the folkloric thing that he was the one who sort of kept them from killing each other in the room. But it does sound like quite a sad record. Because you can tell that they're sort of off on their own, and you know, everything is so kind of, but the ethos of it was that they played everything in the room like the old days, and they sort of gave up with the sort of, you know, people coming, so they were kind of, they forced it out, and it does sound a little bit like that, but there's amazing stuff on it, and they can't wait to see the Peter Jackson thing that's coming quite soon. That's gonna be amazing.
That looks really good.
So if you haven't heard that, imaginary listener, that is Peter Jackson is
still there,
is doing like to this. Doing what he did with the First World War to Let It Be, which was a slightly smaller but no less intense conflict of those aborted documentary movie that they made about it.
I thought you were going to say he's doing what he did to The Hobbit to the Beatles, as in like just turning
turning it into a 6-hour CGI-laden snorefest. That would be incredible to see.
Yeah, that's going to be amazing.
Because there's so much. You've said you've not seen the film.
No.
I think you can only really find it on like YouTube and stuff. But there's some really sweet stuff in there. There's lots of stuff with like George and Ringo writing together, which is really nice. And sort of George sort of teaching him how to play the piano and hit a note beyond his like 4-note range. And so they sort of taking care of each other a bit, and it's really nice.
See that last bit after you've done that bit? But then, like this D minor you did with the other, which means.
Oh, yeah.
But I was going to ask you, what's your most controversial Beatles opinion?
My most...
Because this is quite a good one, because, you know, like, do you have one which you kind of show off with about, you know, like that's just, that's the kind of thing,
yeah,
you know, kind of Sergeant Pepper isn't actually that good kind of vibe. You know, do you have a real one which is cool to kind of show off?
Well, I do think that John Lennon, I don't really understand the sort of deification of John Lennon. I think he's actually a pretty nasty person.
Right, yeah.
And for massive Beatles fans,
I'd say that's
a bit controversial.
It is a bit controversial. You don't need to look very far to find that you're completely 100% accurate.
Yeah. But that's sort of what makes him so fascinating as well. I think probably my one that a lot of, it depends which ones you love the most, but I would maintain that the White Album should be a single record and they should have got rid of half of it. And if it hadn't been a double album and they'd got rid of all the shit on it, like Piggies and Revolution Number 9, and as sort of culturally important as they are musicology wise, I think that album would be up there with the late masterpieces if they hadn't been arguing too much about what track goes where and how many songs to get on the record and stuff.
I disagree, because the White Album is probably my favourite, and I think it kind of needs to be that length because you can kind of get lost in it. It's got little spooky corners. It's like a big abandoned house with loads of different rooms.
Yeah, and some you never go into.
It needs that. Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't listen to Wild Honey Pie, but it sort of needs to be there.
Do you not skip? Honestly, say that you don't skip it if you're listening to it on vinyl or all the way through?
I wouldn't. It's very rare that I'd listen to the entire thing all the way through.
Yeah,
because that is long. Yeah, but I will listen to the first album or the first two sides, as it were.
Yeah,
I always thought, think of it as two albums, basically.
Yeah,
because that was how I heard it, as a double CD. But I will listen to one or the other of those, like as in starting from Birthday, and that's kind of the second one for me.
Yeah,
and. Yeah, but
is
like,
it not? Because I have it on vinyl, and I only ever really tend to pull out the disc that starts with Martha, My Dear. So that must be side two of the second record.
Right. So on the vinyl, is it four records?
Yeah, it'll be four, yeah.
Yeah. But you've got Martha, My Dear, you've got Sexy Sadie.
Blackbird.
Mother Nature's Son.
Yeah, that's great.
Your Blues is great. Everybody's Got Something to Hide.
My Guitar Gently Weeps.
We're just naming songs. My Guitar Gently Weeps.
But
yeah.
You also have Bungalow Piggies, Bill. Revolution Number 9, Honey Pie.
What is Piggies just like? I don't mind Piggies, but is it because of the Manson association that it's a bit...
I just think it's...
horrible to listen to.
I think the Beatles, when I get sort of into... there's so much humour in the music, but when it gets to be a bit sort of twee, that's the side of it that I hate. And also I do find, much as I love George, he's so bitter. And songs like Piggies, I do find a bit like, oh, come on, mate. It's a bit like the Taxman thing. It's just like... just get over it, man.
Wait a second. Hang on. I just thought that song was about pigs.
Well, no, it's about corporate... it's about, you know...
Oh, right. I just purely understood it on a very literal level that this was a song about pigs.
It's all the little piggies in their starched white shirts and, you know, all of that sort of thing. It's about the Alan Klein, just, you know, Apple
stuff. It's about the man,
stuff.
Right.
He really didn't he sugarcoat his metaphors in a way that I suppose it's not really a criticism,
unlike Savoy Truffle.
Yeah, exactly.
My reason for finding that queasy is just to do with the Sharon Tate murders.
Yeah, exactly.
They wrote, you know,
and it went on to have a pretty grisly afterlife.
Yeah, but I don't mind Piggies. I mean. I like Revolution Number 9. I will listen to it.
Mm.
It's, it might be Ian McDonald described it as, you know, the piece of avant-garde music that is owned by the most people, which is a nice way of putting it. And also with, you know, you need Revolution 9 because of the sequence of the album. Like, I think it sounds so nice. It kind of comes in, it's quite spooky.
What's it in between? Can you remember?
It comes in after the "Can you take me back where I came from?" You know, which is really good.
That's straight off something like Ram, that song, I always think.
Yeah. And then it goes into "Cry Baby Cry," which is
amazing.
Yeah, and that was... Oh, no, "Cry Baby Cry," and then it goes into the little "Can You Take Me Back," and then it's Revolution 9, then it's "Goodnight."
Yeah, but "Goodnight" kind of is another one I could quite happily lose.
Yeah, I don't mind "Goodnight."
I mean, you've got to have a Ringo, haven't you?
It just sort of needs to be there. I tell you what I don't like is the Ringo song "Don't Pass Me By." I mean, that is shit.
I was actually thinking one of my talking points was what is the worst song that the Beatles ever recorded, and that would be mine.
That is, and I think there was a podcast I was listening to somewhere. I think it was David Quantick on Rule of Three talking about the Ruttles.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was going to say. Barry Wom's version of the one that is thinly disguised.
Yeah. Which is great, but David Quantick makes the point that "Don't Pass Me By" is 4 minutes long. It's like 4.5 minutes long. It's just so long.
You know, the Beatles didn't write a song over 3 minutes until end of 1964, I think.
Oh, that's a lovely fact.
So definitely four. You know, that's twice as long as "Love Me Do."
I'm going to quickly do my controversial opinion, and this can kind of seep into what's the worst song.
Yeah.
But I'm not a huge fan of Rubber Soul.
Interesting. I kind of agree with you there. I think it's always... because people always clump it together with Revolver, which I think is a far superior record.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm in total agreement.
Because they recorded
it at the same
time.
There's
a bit of time, but released in, you know, so quickly after each other.
Quite quickly, yeah.
But the cliche Rubber is, Soul. They could be one record.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, like I think Harrison says that on the anthology somewhere, you could listen to them back to back, but it's just absolutely not the case. Like, you know, Dr. Robert on Revolver sounds like it could be on Rubber Soul.
Yeah.
And maybe, like, Norwegian Wood, something could be on Revolver, maybe.
Yeah, I think you could swap those two around. Girl is the track that I always think could be on Revolver as well.
Yeah, Girl is good. Drive My Car is good. And you can hear the production is getting better and crisper, and, like, Drive My Car is really good. And Nowhere Man. And In My Life, of course. Yeah. You know, I'm not slagging those incredible songs.
Yeah.
But it's got What Goes On on there, which is the one which is like Ringo's... So I don't mean this to be we're slagging off Ringo at all, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of part of the Beatles podcast, isn't it?
Yeah, but... I love him.
Lovely man.
I love Ringo, yeah. I mean, What Goes On is the first song on the second side, I think.
Mm.
And it's Ringo's actual first writing credit, isn't it? Because it's a Lennon-McCartney-Starkey song. Yeah. And it is, you know, it's just a country pastiche. It's not too bad. But I just think it's... It's a bit... It is... It actually is quite bad.
No, it is. It's definitely sounds like it's one of... I think all of his songs sound like they took longer to record than they did to write.
Yeah. There's a great... I mean, one of the lyrics is, "I met you in the morning, waiting for the tides of time."
God, that's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, which Ian McDonald says, like, tides of time is like he's trying to be a bit Dylan-esque, but "I met you in the morning" is quite...
Yeah, maybe in the
it's
morning.
Not much. Yeah.
That is, but I think that it's that whole record is the most Dylan influenced, and
definitely
it really shows in especially Lennon's writing, because he was such a, like, you know, hip faddy person. You can sort of spot his times when he's like super obsessive. Norwegian Wood is pure Bob Dylan.
Yeah, but it's funny. I mean, I mean, much as I love this era of Dylan, we're talking like blonde on blonde era.
I think for George. I think George got into him first, and it was just after Another Side had come out. So the irony was that the Beatles were influenced by Dylan and went down a more acoustic direction, while the same thing is happening with Dylan, and he went into bringing it back home after hearing, I think, it might have been Rubber Soul. So at the same time, they were sort of crossing paths in opposite directions.
Yeah. And that's another reason where it's like that Dylan stuff going electric is so amazing. And that's, for me, better than Rubber Soul.
Yeah.
And then also, Rubber Soul was the kind of catalyst for Pet Sounds.
Yeah.
And Pet Sounds is, like, by far the superior album, yeah. I think. And then Smile was going to be, obviously, this is, you know, stuff that's been gone over 100 times, but, like, Smile was going to be the answer to Revolver. But during the making of Smile, Brian Wilson heard Sgt. Pepper, and, you know, that was too much.
Yeah.
But...
is that one of those... Is that an apocryphal story? Because...
Yeah, I think it is pure. It is a bit apocryphal, but
yeah, because I've heard so many people sort of talk about that moment and him pulling over the car, hearing Norwegian Wood, and being like, "I'm going straight to the studio to record a new record." Yeah. Is that pretty sure that's not how recording records works?
No, I don't know. Yeah. So for me, like Rubber Soul is obviously these touchstones in the kind of folk rock thing, and then in the kind of chamber pop thing.
Yeah.
But Rubber Soul on its own doesn't stand up against those things for me. That's like that. So that's my issue with Rubber Soul. And also, Rubber Soul has "Run for Your Life" on it, which is just so dreadful. Yeah. The John Lennon song about.
And it's a bit that's definitely before his sort of feministic awakenings.
Yeah, I think he actually made the point of disowning that song and saying it was misogynistic.
What was it? Catch you with another man, that's the end, little girl.
Yeah, I'd rather see you dead than with another man.
It's really bad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. So, yeah, I think it's an album of moments that sort of indicate what is going to come on Revolver, and that sort of the sort of baroque George Martin piano solo in My Life and stuff is obviously them playing around with techniques that would then, like, you can see they're sort of getting used to the studio and making themselves comfortable in that way. So
yeah,
I think I absolutely agree. I think it's definitely it sounds like a precursor to Revolver.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So Jack, because we were just chatting because you were doing it on Instagram, a Beatles for Sale Jigsaw.
Dang.
And you said you gave up on it because it was impossible.
It was impossible.
I think, like, but surely, I mean,
I'm not physically possible.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying you're a bad workman blaming your tools, but do you think you might need to take a bit of blame about not finishing the jigsaw, or are you blaming the jigsaw?
I am 110% blaming the jigsaw. It's badly made. It's shoddily painted. There are bits that have little sort of nubbins on them that don't, so you have to sort of cut them off, but that changes the...
You had to cut them off?
Yeah,
So Beatles for Sale, if you haven't seen the cover, there's the four chaps. It's quite an autumnal kind of picture, isn't it? They're in black overcoats. There's a lot of black with the overcoats,
and
there's a lot of beetle hair. There's a lot of beetle hair.
Mm-hmm.
So is that what you were getting lost with?
Thankfully, not as much as the hair in the latter records. But I didn't have a problem with the long hair it's just a badly exposed picture. I think it was one of those...
Right.
I think it was it not the record where they went to look at it, the cover, and then it sort of fell down on the projector and got a bit warped. Like, so it was up...
It's got like the nice kind of almost exposed... Or kind of flare thing.
They should have thought about that before they did it, because
right before they turned it into a jigsaw. I mean,
it's also not a surprise that that's where they stopped making the Beatles jigsaws.
Babies in Black is on
I love that.
Which is good.
Yeah. In turn, because I'm I am a singer, so those sort of that McCartney era and stuff on his voice on that record for someone so young, especially on Kansas City, Hey Hey Hey, which was, you know, they did live for basically the whole thing, but his voice is just nuts.
Yeah, McCartney's voice is incredible.
And I don't think he gets enough credit for it, really.
Yeah, the kind of screaming he can do as well on something like Oh Darling or something, like right at the end.
Yeah.
His voice is amazing.
Oh Darling is my embarrassing drunken party piece.
Oh, really?
Yeah, if I've had about 8 pints, then it's pretty inevitable at a house party that I used to get out Oh Darling.
I'll get out the guitar.
Scream
as well.
At the tongue of my lungs.
Oh,
no!
Jesus.
I'd usually
kind of pod.
No, I've been
just sing along to
just
the record.
Sing along to the record, yeah.
Wow, kind of Puddle of Mud style, just
yeah. But yeah,
I mean, Ringo's drumming on "Oh Darling" is, I think, his finest drumming.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant.
I think he's incredible on that.
It's absolutely brilliant. Did you ever play the video game Beatles Rock Band?
No, I didn't. I never got into those kind of... Is this kind of like the guitar thing?
Yeah, but it came with a drum kit. And if you put it on expert level, you could play it pretty much sort of in the way that it is played by hitting sort of yellow every... The toms are different colours and the snares are different colour and you have to sort of hit all the different things. And, I've got a newfound respect for Ringo's drumming after loads of drunken nights of Beatles Rock Band.
His drumming is amazing. I don't know whether that kind of... this is a very hackneyed stuff, isn't it? Talking about Ringo as a drummer. But, you know, I think he's brilliant.
But he is, yeah. Because I'm back in the sort of village where I grew up, and there's a guy down the road who used to be the drummer in Jethro Tull. And I was chatting to him about Ringo, and he's in, you know, he's Jethro Tull, obviously massively virtuosic 10-minute drum solos, and technically, I think John Bonham said that this guy was the best rock drummer he'd ever seen. So he's very good at the drums, the way that he talks about Ringo's drumming is just unbelievable. Yeah, he's so influential. Cool. He's a drummer's drummer. It's just a shame that they let him sing a song on every record.
Well, you know, I didn't. You need that though. You need this. You need to beat the Ringo.
Yeah,
song,
I mean, I wonder
you?
When that decision was made, because it certainly seems like there must have been a record where, like, this record's really good. Do we have to give him a song?
But then, with a little help from my friends, there's a lot. That couldn't be anyone else singing it.
That's true.
And I like Ringo singing
it. Octopus's Garden as well. I think they probably just upped the quality of the songs they gave him.
Yeah, well, Ringo wrote Octopus's Garden, didn't he? I mean...
Did he actually?
That is... Yeah, that's his... Don't Pass Me By and Octopus's Garden are the two Beatles songs he wrote.
Well, in the documentary that we mentioned earlier, you can see George Harrison... writing it with him on the piano and showing him the chord.
Oh, cool.
So I assume that's one thing, that actually he didn't have that much to do with it.
Yeah. My friend always finds it funny that in Octopus's Garden there's the line about no one there to tell me what to do, which reminds me of Alan Partridge with the traffic cone, you know, Michael.
Yeah.
Stop telling me what to do. That kind of
King Road
thing. King Road, yeah.
And also, who's telling you what to do, Ringo?
Yeah, I know.
You're in the Beatles,
the octopus?
Mate.
Oh, wait,
Maureen,
possibly. Also, John Lennon plays really nice guitar on Octopus's Garden.
Yeah,
like, his guitar playing on that's amazing.
It's a great sounding record, and that is the perfect. I mean, as you're saying, you do need them, and that's the perfect like bit of respite that you need. Just before that monumental B-side. Do you have a favourite Beatle? That's the most route one question.
Route one, yeah. It was George for a long... Well, it was George for a long time, because I think I just got really into... When I was getting those albums from my dad and stuff, I would just try and find the George song and going through the B-sides as well, because my dad had a lot of the 7-inches, and obviously there are a lot of non-album singles. Mm. So I really loved one called The Inner Light, I think it was the B-side to Lady Madonna, which is such a good song.
Is that the and, one that's me and quite, my brother, is that a very sort of Indian-inflected one in one of George's?
It's got an Indian thing, it's also got mandolin on it. It sounds very like The Incredible String Band or something like that. It's got a kind of almost, quite strange folky thing. I really like that song. And, I think me and my brother got really into Blue Jay Way, the Magical Mystery Tour. Just we used to love that song. You know, it's such a... It felt so ahead of its time, and it was really trippy and really, you know, just zoning out to it. It was such a cool song.
Mm.
And I just loved kind of all Harrison stuff, and like going all the way back even to like It Don't Bother Me on the...
Really? You like that?
With the Beatles. Yeah, that's a really good song.
I think that would be a contender for one of my worst Beatles songs.
Really? Wow, I think that's good. And it was just the kind of my way into it. It was like I just sort of... My favourite Beatles song is Long, Long, Long from the White Album.
Oh, nice.
Which I just think is just so beautiful and so interesting dynamically. It's so quiet.
Yeah.
It's unbelievably quiet, that song. And it's just got incredible dynamism to it. It's like a kind of talk song or something. And it's just very, very just beautiful song.
And that's George. I always thought that was John's song.
Yeah, that's a George song. So it was always George, but then it was kind of like, I just got very into John and John's solo career, and, you know, I love... But yeah, I think I was always kind of preferred John's to Paul's stuff. But then as I've got older, I probably prefer Paul now.
Yeah.
Because I don't know.
I am, as you can tell from my soft spot for Queen, you could probably guess that I'm a Paul man.
Right,
I don't mind a bit of cheese.
Yeah, no, but that's fine.
Yeah.
But, Paul definitely is the one of choice for the kind of the studio nerd, the kind of music-y, nerdy kind of thing. I'm not saying that's kind of you, but do you know that kind of...
I know exactly what you mean. If you're in terms... I mean, I'm a music... You know, I did music as a degree and stuff, so I'm very interested in how naturally sort of composition came to him. And there's an amazing bit in the... I know you've read the Ian McDonald book, but it was a bit... Because I was rereading the introduction the other day, and he just absolutely nails the John Paul thing in a paragraph that... I can't really see it well there. It says, "In a less narrowly structured sense, the two represent the classic clash between truth and beauty, seeing music as a vehicle of thought and feeling. Lennon stressed expression at the expense of formal elegance, which he held held no interest for him or value per se. Intuitive, he cared little for technique and nothing for the rules, which he would go out of his way to break. As a result, while sometimes obsessive and crabbed, his music rarely betrays itself and hardly ever strays unintentionally into bad taste. On the other hand, McCartney, by nature drawn to music's formal aspects yet wholly untutored, produced technically finished work almost entirely by instinct, his harmonic judgment based mainly on perfect pitch and acute set of ears. However, while his music at its best is the very opposite of inexpressive, he could, entranced by his own fluency, all too easily be distracted from meaning, producing glib pettiness, vapid exercises in style, and excruciating lapses of taste."
That's brilliant. I quite like the way I thought you said acute set of ears as well.
He does have a cute set of ears.
But that's brilliantly put. I love that.
Yeah,
another interesting... Like, my friend, I think it was my friend Alex, pointed out a thing to do with that Beefheart is a bit Lennon and Zappa is a bit Paul.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite good, because that's another two school friends. Extraordinary to think... Well, actually, John and Paul weren't at school together, were they? Of a similar age. Mm. They met at a similar age. And I think that's another kind of interesting way of looking at them, where Beefheart, there's the more kind of... Yeah, it's more about soul.
Yeah, it's more effortless, I suppose. Definitely.
Yeah, and with Zappa, Zappa at his worst is completely and utterly awful, and like and it's just too much technicality, isn't it? You know,
and he's also not afraid to be sort of quite uncool. Whereas
uncool, yeah, taste is an issue with Zappa, and
yeah,
obviously,
I mean, just look at that mustache.
You know, obsession with obsession with pastiche as well. Like McCartney was, it's kind of about pastiching.
But then, weirdly, I am more of a Beefheart person than a Zappa person. So that's
me too, definitely.
That I, and when it's that way round. But I think that's the amazing thing, isn't it? I mean, if you were to, if you had to sort of, you know, be reductive about it, it is the fact that those two people are in the same band at the same time that makes the Beatles the Beatles. And it's the, you know, especially when they're writing together, which they did, you know, less and less as it went on. But that was an interesting little thing that I was thinking about yesterday is, would you, if you could go back, would you rather have had 10 more years of the Beatles, or would you rather have them left it there?
Well, I think in many ways, because the Beatles story is so fascinating, because they were doing so many things for the first time. So in terms of touring and playing concerts of that size, and in terms of using the studio, and in terms of trying to create their own management company, you know, obviously issues with copyright, kind of the boring stuff like that. So it would be interesting to see how the Beatles would function in a kind of, in like, let's say, the 80s or the 90s, when the music industry was at its most powerful, let's say, or in the 70s even, where there was that infrastructure to do big concerts with proper amplification and proper PAs and stuff, you know, and the potential to do shows like Genesis did with huge production values and hundreds of instruments. Because that was the whole thing. The Beatles stopped touring because they couldn't recreate what they were doing in the studio and they couldn't hear themselves. So I think it would be interesting to see how the Beatles would have dealt with the infrastructure of the 70s of the music industry.
Yeah. I can't
imagine. Because they would have been able to tour.
Can't. No, the Beatles at Wembley doesn't really sit in my mind.
It would be shit, actually. The more I say it, the more crap it would be.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, that's why I think it's best left as it is, because it's kind of perfect, isn't it? But that would be a kind of interesting angle, I guess.
I think I kind of agree.
Yeah, that's interesting. But the problem is, it's the Beatles were of their time and place. So if they'd have done that in the 80s, it wouldn't be the Beatles, really, would it? It would be a different band.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
Well, unless they were like the Stones and just sort of kept on playing rock and roll music.
Kept going.
Another 70 years or whatever it is.
I mean, yeah, I just can't imagine it.
No, I think definitely there's probably, when you listen to the solo records that they all put out immediately after the Beatles, there's definitely one more absolutely superb record in there.
Yeah.
But then they're all so, you know, they're all debate about how they fucking hate each other. So I don't know how that would have worked. I mean, even Double Fantasies is basically an 80s album, and it's also really bad.
Yeah.
He really, some of his later output before he did his sort of stay at home dad stuff is, there's the odd track like Mind Games and stuff, but everything on that record is pretty dross. It's almost incredible that such a genius can write such a poor album. But then he was
And he could be incredibly sentimental as well, couldn't he? And like, you know, as obviously Paul gets the stick for being the kind of sentimental one, but some Lennon stuff is so mawkish.
Yeah,
Well, Imagine, for example, is just, it's just you know, a bit.
Yeah, shit. It is. It's very sort of middle class hippie crap music.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it's one of the worst tracks on that record.
Yeah, I love the album. Imagine,
the
album's brilliant,
amazing. And if you could,
How Do You Sleep? It's so good.
I find it difficult, man.
Yeah,
like it's so nasty.
It's so mean.
And when you watch the documentary of the making of it, and you just see, have you seen the documentary? When he's talking to Harrison and he's playing him the song, and you can see this look of like manic glee on his face when he's talking about like how nasty it is. And then
that's really
there's that
unpleasant
take where he's like, "How do you sleep, you cunt?" Screaming it down the microphone. You're just like, mate, for fuck's sake.
Chill out. For God's sake.
He's nice. He's Heaven's nice, sake. Chubby, cheeky, chubby Paul.
Yeah. Well, they loved each other, really. So my question, it's a kind of, I suppose, an abstract one, really. But my question is, did the Beatles exist?
Yes.
So what I mean by that, I don't mean in the sense of the Yesterday film of, you know, imagine a world where the Beatles didn't exist, etc. But sometimes I'm listening to the Beatles and I'm reading about the story and it's all so good and the narrative is so extraordinary, the pace...
Yeah.
Something seems completely unreal about it. And it's almost nice to imagine that the Beatles were actually a government conspiracy to promote, you know, a sense of goodwill in the post-war era. There wouldn't have been a 60s without the Beatles.
Yeah, right? Definitely not.
But there wouldn't have been the Beatles without the 60s, if you see what I mean.
Sure, yeah.
So, like, it's kind of this incredible growth that you saw in all kinds of cultural directions was, you know, because of the Beatles. You know, the Beatles were part of it, but it was kind of because of the Beatles as well. They started this kind of a new sense of kind of, technicolor kind of expression, I suppose. So you know, this kind of goes back to what I was saying about their hair growth. But, like, let's look at the White Album just for a second. Yeah. What I don't understand about the White Album was, up until then, there'd been a few kind of acoustic songs on albums and stuff, right? Like, there'd been they often got the acoustic guitar out. Yesterday's kind of a nice thing. But on the White Album, they're all, like, amazing finger-picking guitarists all of a sudden. It's, like, extraordinary, the development.
The proficiency of John Lennon's guitar playing on that record. I mean, you're a guitarist as well. You'll know if you've ever played something like Julia. And some of the chord shifting stuff and the finger picking is like, when did you learn to do that? Because you haven't been doing that
right.
on any other record.
Dear Prudence is really hard. Yeah. Happiness is a Warm Gun. It's got lovely finger picking. And then Paul McCartney, obviously, you know, Mother Nature's Son, Blackbird, are just lovely, like, beautiful folk guitar playing.
Yeah.
It's almost like they were too good.
Yeah. It's all very convenient, isn't it?
Yeah. But they were too good because they were the Beatles.
Yeah.
So it's this kind of like this synchronicity between the culture that created the Beatles and the Beatles themselves. It's like they got that good because they were the Beatles.
Yeah. You know? The slip up in their cover story, if it is indeed a government conspiracy, is the sort of yesterday thing falling out of the sky. Because they're full of serendipitous moments where it does seem a little bit too neat. You know, I can just about see how the timing of four people meeting each other at that time, but it seems to be all the drugs turned up at the right place. They went to all the right parties, met all the right people, and also just encapsulated that sort of narrative of being sort of, you know, a working class, upwardly, you know, it's the decade of social mobility and it's the decade of, you know.
And it's so much of it, I was reading the other day, this is in Dreaming the Beatles, this thing of John and Paul, when they were learning the guitar, they knew a few chords, but they heard there was a guy across town who knew how to play B7. And so they got on the bus. And they got on the bus to meet the guy. And nowadays, of course, you just Google the bus timetable, wouldn't you? And then head off on the bus to get your B7. But there's so much. That's so rich in symbolism, isn't it? As a post-war culture, you're kind of looking. You know, you've got kind of your two chords, and you're moving away and trying to get the third chord. And then everything is expanding, and you know, you're finding out more information is growing across the world. You know. I'm not trying to say the 60s were all this incredible time, because obviously it wasn't. It was horrific and there was so much shit going on. But, you know, this idea of youth culture growing and of pop music being created and rock being created and art being created was just completely expanding at this unbelievable level.
Yeah.
And it was like the Beatles were the kind of like... They're the little narrative of that actually happening in real time.
Yeah, and it's all documented,
which is
on record. So it's I mean, that is the staggering thing that.
So how can you go in 10 years from like learning the third chord and having to get a bus to find it to Abbey Road,
Abbey Road side B, and She Never Gives You Your Money and stuff. It's, I mean, compared. I mean, certainly from a musician's point of view, when I think about what I was doing 10 years 10 years ago. I don't think it's quite that dramatic.
It's not that scale. Yeah. It's not the same scale.
But it's. I mean, it's massive. I mean, like, the thing I always think, and as you get older, you think when George Harrison started, you know, he was 17.
Yeah,
and was only 27 when it stopped.
Yeah, that's
which is unbelievable. Which is that, frankly, disgusting.
It's depressing. Yeah. It's bleak.
So he's pretty, 10 years younger than me when he finished the Beatles, almost. Yeah. God.
That was the introductory episode of Your Own Personal Beatles, which was very nice to listen back to, and formative experiences, gropingly. I don't know why I used the word groping. We were just getting to know each other. I think that was the vibe.
Listening back to it, it felt like it had been recorded a year ago. We've lived in such strange times, but...
It was extremely hot that day. And there have been different phases of lockdown, haven't there? There have been... It's been a true dystopia, hasn't it? There was a kind of the normal people phase. Do you remember when everyone was watching Normal People?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That seems like a long time ago.
Yeah. And then, you know, there was the Tiger King phase. Yeah. And now we're very much in the I May Destroy You phase. And they're all different epochs, aren't they? You know?
Yeah. It's quite a good way to sort of bookmark the
people's
collective viewing habits, which everyone said was a thing of the past.
Yeah. The things we've kind of been watching to kind of distract from feelings of doom.
I think the other thing that I've found really interesting since we recorded that episode quite a long time ago is I've been very saturated in the Beatles since then. We've been talking to all these amazing guests, and I went back and read a little bit of Ian McDonald's book and stuff, and you just realise when you're sort of hyper aware of it, every encounter that I run into with the Beatles on a day-to-day life, it's just extraordinary how many times. I don't know if it's one of those serendipitous things, like when you learn a new word and you hear it all the time. But it's just, the Vodafone advert's got Come Together on it. I was watching Alan Partridge this morning. He talks about it.
Yeah, I don't know as well if it's the algorithms listening as well, because I see on Instagram I just seems to get constant Beatles kind of recommended posts and things like that. Or, you know, you might like this... £20,000 guitar from the 60s that was touched by George Harrison.
Yeah, my YouTube my YouTube recommendations are pretty much 100% Beatles.
Yeah, but and since we posted the trailer as well, I had lots of people getting in touch. Like my friend Kimberly sent me a link to a BBC Storyville documentary called How the Beatles Rocked the Kremlin, which I'm going to watch later this week. Have you seen that?
I've seen it, yeah, it's great.
It's kind of about how the Beatles won the Cold War.
Yeah.
so that's going to be it.
Yeah, and that could be another one to discuss in an upcoming conversation of why did the Beatles really exist.
Yeah, indeed.
So thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with a very exciting guest. And as always, you can follow us on all of the social media things. And if you want to get in touch, or maybe you could suggest someone whose personal Beatles you would like to hear for us to try and get in touch with, you can email me on jack@homespunsounds.com, or you can go to personalbeatles.com/contact.
See you next time.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.